You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Here we go. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I have the delight of speaking to an old friend. And it's interesting, right? I still think of you as a friend, even though we've barely spoken in the last 500 years. And really, isn't that interesting how that happens? I like that. So Susan Harper, and you know, I ask people for bios and things, and then I started to think about what to say about you. So I'm going to ask you to say about you. Well, so Susan Harper, not what do you do, but what do you call yourself other than Susan Harper?
What do I call myself? Well, I do call myself a friend. So I want to start just there, as you mentioned that. And I think it's true, when we open a realm of friendship earlier in our life, even if we don't find all the ways of maintaining it in obvious ways, if there's some kind of really deep link like that, friend.
Yes.
Names.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So I am a friend. I would call myself a friend.
But you're not a professional friend.
No, not a professional friend.
So what are you, a professional?
Yeah. So primarily I'm known as a teacher of continuum, which is a movement art, and it's a really a deep way to somatically and in the deep imaginal capacity of us befriend the mystery, open to the mystery, open to the unknown in a somatic way. And as well in a really on a level that works on all of us, all aspects of us. And then I'm also sometimes called a heart soul counselor. So sometimes I'm guiding people, counseling matters of the heart and
with words.
Journeys.
With words. Counseling.
With both words. Yeah, both words and somatic practice, like help the deep felt sense capacities open so that each person could have a connection to their own deep felt sense, heart-based intelligence.
I love that. And I'm imagining people hearing that, and this percentage of them say, oh, I get that. And the rest of them is like, wait, what is she like a dancer? Is she like a counselor? Is she like a psychologist? They're you know, the gears are moving and they're trying to sort, where do I put this? Where do I put this, this category that this woman just tried to explain? And so I can, not so I can, this is not me speaking, not so I can contain it, but so I can know, I can get a sense of what territory I'm in, so that things might flow from it. So do people, well, you travel in circles where people know what you do, and people ask you to do the things you do, and so they know what they're getting themselves in for. But somebody who's listening to this says, okay, well, continuum, somatic. I know somatic, that means body, and it's imaginal. So what is that means mind. And see, okay, so now I will tell you now, how would I describe Susan Harper and what she does? And that's why I put it on you, because I was stuck. I think of you as a somatic explorer, and your primary instrument, I don't know what how else to say that, for understanding the world and human beings in it and things is tissue, is your body and movement. And that too, you know, it's almost like years ago I read about sharks and their uncanny ability to discern the pressures exerted on them by the water and the currents of the water that sort of gave them information about, ooh, that's emotion that might be a fish in distress, which is good because, you know, I want to eat it. Or that might be danger. And so I'm going that way. And they had this, I was jealous of it. They had this uncanny, at least to us, uncanny ability to experience the world through pressures exerted on their tissue. And so I think of you as somebody who is, sure, you've got all those other things that mere mortals have, but you also have been exploring the world using movement and how you are affected and how you affect. And anyway, and I think that too will be mysterious to people. What does that mean? How does somebody do that? So you mentioned continuum, and that's how I know you from way back when which was, it was kind of dance, and making friends with the unexperienced portions of, at least for me, of my tissue. It was discovering places in myself through movement that I didn't even know were there. And I guess I want to ask you, I mean, this has been a lifelong journey, exploration for you. So how do you explain that? Was this like, you know, you sprung out of your parents' head in this way that you popped into the world with this inclination? Or was it something that was developed over time? And how? Who was Susan Harper when she was a little kid? And
yeah, there was many different themes there.
Sorry.
Yeah, so it's okay. It's like somatic explorer. That was back. Oh, yeah.
About a mile ago.
And that's one way to describe the work, somatic exploration. Another way that I sometimes say it is that help people enter into exploratory consciousness, and consciousness that's in the 70 trillion cells of us. There's so much of us that is not known to us. And so much intelligence happening. Like, I don't have to figure out how to breathe all night long. I don't have to figure out how to digest for my heart to beat. All the many intelligent processes that our organism is going through. And throughout all of us, we have somatic memory of all the events that have ever occurred and our either reaction or responses to those. We have ways of coming in to our somatic, our body, and exploring in inquiry and in movement and not assuming that we already know. Mm-hmm. So that's a really big one, is mm-hmm. to be able to be in the not knowing, but be in a kind of somatic inquiry. And I would also say perceptual inquiry. And this is one of the places I love the most, is exploring how we're perceiving. So when you're describing the shark, and they're taking in all kinds of information through the pressure, through the movement of the waveforms that are happening, and then their whole organismic intelligence system is determining, is that food? Is that danger? Is that a big boat? What is it? So there's a constant responsiveness to context, listening and taking in all the raw information and then making sense out of it. And we explore also that way similarly in us, so that maybe we had a habit that if we heard a sound, it meant duck, 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 and I go into a reactive state. Instead, I might be able to slow myself down, take that more raw data, feel the reaction about to occur, and pause and settle back down into the deep intelligence of the heart and the body, and have another moments of inquiry to see, how else might I respond here? So continuum, let's just say, because we've used the word continuum, was originated and developed primarily by Emily Conrad. Mm-hmm. And I joined Emily in the work of continuum, which is primarily a body of work involving movement and sounding, but it's primarily inquiry based. It's not giving people a set of routines. Mm-hmm. It's more giving a principle, or giving a like a way of playing, but with a lot of openness to see what actually happens. And so in that, it brings us into an exploratory state. Like, if I make this kind of sound that vibrates in my tissues, in my bones, in my blood, in my cellular tissues, what begins to happen? And so sometimes what happens is that we have our energies, our nervous system starts to settle and widen and open, and different feeling states begin to arrive. There's ways of exploring somatically that are somatic imagination. Before, when I used the word imagination and you said mind, mm-hmm. we could say mind, but it's like mind-body, mind-heart-body all at once. Mm-hmm. And that somatic imagination, meaning coming in, sounding, moving, and beginning to feel mostly rapport with the larger natural world and all of the elemental intelligences that move in us, that are us, the way water, outside water, inside water, waters of the planet, the salty waters and the fresh waters inside of us has deep resonance. It's the same water, just taking different shapes inside of our body.
As I remember time with Emily, I remember her struggling in all sorts of ways to put it in words. And frequently it kind of came over as art. And, you know, she was struggling, like, or the way words come over as poetry, and some people understand it, and some people are like, what? I don't get that. What's that? And I think that I'm curious, after all these years, because that's where we know each other from, was from continuum. And at least as I understand it, you've been, you know, not because of what you just said, you know, it's not a preset, prescribed, it's not like doing calisthenics. Mm-hmm. Right? Or, you know, could you write that routine down for me? No. Right? Or, you know, could you choreograph that? No. It really was more exploratory and more coming from people's tissue, bodies, But I'm wondering, so after all these years of doing that, all those years way past when I was doing it, has there been, is there, I don't know what to call it, for lack of a better word, innovation in continuum? Has it moved forward or backward or up or down or whichever way things move in meaningful ways? Has it continued to evolve and develop and become over the many years?
Yes.
Could you say a little more about that?
Yes, I can say some more about that. Yeah. No, I think first of all, throughout Emily's lifetime, there was constant development, innovation, movement.
Yes.
Through our interaction, through our partnering for the years that happened, then there was also like movement and evolution. And now it's held by, for example, we have a Continuum Teacher Association. And in that, everyone who joins that Continuum Teacher Association, it's understood that continuum, like life, is a living creative process. And so it's going to continue to morph and develop and grow in all kinds of different ways. There's many teachers now in Europe, in Japan, and all over the United States and Canada. And so as teachers take up this work and they're meeting the cultural situation that they're in, there's going to be innovation and exploration. So these days we encourage people, if you want to understand or know more about it, come study with a few different teachers so that you feel the growth and movement and development of it. Mm. It's a creative art primarily, and it can have some very powerful healing capacities to it, but really always primarily it's a creative art. And when Emily was working to find out how to describe what she was experiencing and sensing very directly, then poetry ends up really being the best way, because it's something that's so felt in experience. It's like trying to tell someone what is water who's never had water.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a direct experience. And in a way, we could say the work is about creating a depth of experiencing capacity. How can I like come in and experience movement, or in perceiving, if I'm like standing before like an amazing tree in the forest, I can be in the classifying mind that says fir, birch, cedar, or I can be standing in front of that tree and be in a perceiving rapport with tree, that tree. And through the heart's capacity for resonance, I can come into a way of knowing, a way of experiencing that is, I'm attuned to the process of treeing, to the barking and the reaching and the eating of light and the rooting and the taking up of nourishment. And that's part of our human heart capacity, is to be in resonance with the living medicine of the natural world. And that we can actually feel that in a direct felt sense kind of a way. But if somebody has never ever felt that way, then what I'm saying is going to be odd language, but it can't be known only by the classifying intellect. This is a heart intelligence and a capacity to experience in depth and breadth. And so in a way, continuum is about helping people have a deeper capacity of experiencing their own nervous system, their own somatic intelligence that's organically connected to nature. It's organically connected to the living processes of life and death. There's dying happening, birthing happening every single moment.
Well, now I have so many questions, and I don't want to get bogged down I can hear Emily either laughing or yelling at me. I was about to say, I don't want to get bogged down in continuum, but what you just said, to what end? What have you noticed a theme, a driving force, clusters of what brings people to this work? Not your work, but the folks that you work with. Why do they show up? Why are they knocking on the door or coming to the workshop or whatever it is? Are there clusters of those things?
Yes. Yeah, there are. So I would say most of the people who come and who have resonance with this work are people who just have a sense that there's something more to life than what the mainstream culture projects, offers, imagines. Mm-hmm. That there is a yearning and a longing and already like a creative spark of life in someone where they want to know a way to have a more multidimensional life experience and to not just be in the flat zone all the time, not just take things in the realm of classifying this as that, not be in the polarized ideological. It's like sometimes you have an ideology instead of real thinking. Mm-hmm. But there you feel
many times.
Yes. And there you feel like at least I can belong to this ideology. But ideology doesn't give us a way to have deep, profound, thoughtful thinking process, mm-hmm. feeling process. So I would say most of the people who come and have resonance, they come, your podcast is called Curiosity Invited, because there's a deep realm of curiosity in somebody. And there's already some place where there's a love for inquiry. There's some theme where it's like, okay, I want to crack the cultural identity or the cultural sets of beliefs. You know, when we have a belief, we need to help get it undone so we can keep opening to a greater experience of reality. Mm-hmm. And this word reality, it's like been taken over. Like we have a reality TV show, Confusion for Reality.
Yeah.
Reality President. It's like, no, wait. The word reality is a totality of wholeness. It's like huge, enormous, vast. It's not small. So sometimes people say, oh, you're full of imagination. Get back to reality. And then, yes, it's a narrow form of imagination. It's more fantasy, but imagination, like reality itself, is full of imagination. If you look at the whole cosmos and all of the stars that have been birthed and the planets and this planetary body and its intelligence, it's full of imagination. How many species has this planetary body birthed and death in the entire life of this planetary body? It's imagination embodied. And so this body can play in the imagination of nature and have an attunement there. So we're not just in human-made constructs, human-made imagination, but really attuned to the imagination in nature.
And would you say, I'm not trying to force you to say it, but would you say, over the years that you've witnessed or you watched people or yourself grow healthier or grow more equanimous, more at ease?
Yes, it's one of really the great pleasures I have of teaching all the things I teach, which is continuum, perceptual work, dream work, all the various things I've studied and then have now gone on to teach. Mm-hmm. It's one of the hugest pleasures for me as a teacher. Mm. So I can watch one person after another be like,
yeah,
in terms of be delivered into profound insights. And an insight is deeper than just an aha moment. It's like an insight that rearranges the paradigm of how someone is living and where they're living from. And in a way, there's a place where you come to such a deep center of well-being that's connected to wholeness, that then I can be with the momentary panic or the momentary fear or the momentary reactivity or the momentary anguish that's arising and feel out what's needed here. There's a deeper sense of well-being that allows a capacity to be with the difficult sensations, the difficult feelings, those things that wake us in the night. And so then it's like there's a relational dynamic. I am both the part of me that's afraid, and I'm the part of me that comes to be with that part that's afraid. And to, it's like a form of love and a form of awareness that's basically like right there, like, yes, I'm afraid. And yes, right here to be with that experience and to be really fully with it in the sensations and allow the sensations the time they need to unfold. And the thought process, it's like when fear strikes, we go into an older part of the brain that thinks in terms of offense, defend, revenge, goes to the worst kind of imagination if we don't catch the moment. We start to imagine the worst, don't we? We have like pretty much like a media that's full of imagining everything possible, the worst. If we can catch the moment of fear, it's like holding a small child that just became afraid. And if you want to like take up a child, it's like, oh yeah, you're afraid. Let's settle with that. Let's be with that. Let me be with you while you're exploring whatever that is. That relational moment is a moment of heart kindness. It's a moment of heart curiosity. It's a moment of like deep, use the word equanimous, like a deep kind of equanimity of being, like a ground of being, to be with what it is that's emergent, that's like dysregulated, and helping the nervous system like regulate again. And if we can't do that, maybe we've had kind of different kinds of trauma, we need co-regulating to regulate with another person who's not afraid with us until we learn what it's like to be in a relational, inner relational dynamism. And this, all the different kinds of work that I teach are helping people grow in that capacity. So a deeper sense of being for the most part happens, and people start to feel a more of a creative life. And just my observation with Emily, it's like what called her to start to create Continuum, what called Emily to create Continuum in the first place is that she was in deep existential pain. What was going on in the culture? And she wasn't seeing like profound initiatory rites that help modern humans be delivered into the greater mystery, into the unknown, into a larger life capacity, creative capacity. And instead of acting out of that existential pain, she moved through it in a creative process. And many of our really deeply creative innovators throughout life, throughout human history, have met, really, they've been in traumatic situations, but found their way through art, through painting, through writing, through poetizing, through spiritual awakening. And those are the teachers that really have brought through the most creative and loving capacity. So it's like, let's meet the anguish. And then let's see what are the deep resources underlying that anguish, where we can meet it, take care of that, and bloom further.
That was lovely.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. It also occurred to me before when you were speaking that, so you spoke about there's a Continuum Teachers Association, and there's an acceptance of or a willingness to an encouragement perhaps to the people in the teachers of Continuum to explore and to go forward or go into or go more. And I wonder if there's a fretting over, fretting may be the wrong word, quality control, for lack of a better way of saying it, right? You know, I've done some things for a very long time. Some of the realizations I've had, some of the ideas I've had, some were in hindsight boneheaded and mistaken. They got me someplace to get to realize that, but so is there a concern about that? And one can imagine the response to that being, you know, they become the Continuum Gestapo, you know, the Continuum police. Like, oh, no, that's not right. Or the Queen, yes. Yes, that is okay. And that is not. And I'm wondering how that works in a practice that is not anything goes. And at the same time, you know, wants to encourage imagination, discovery, inquiry. And it's the tension perhaps between anything that is, you'll excuse the expression, institutionalized and a living thing. And I'm exactly wondering how that plays itself out there.
Yeah, thank you. It's a great question. And yes, of course, there's concern always. And the desire for those of us who founded the Teacher Association was to lean in the direction of it's a living process and not to want to systematize and itemize and proceduralize the work itself,
yeah,
but to have really deep, clear principles that this is based on. And one of that is about organismic intelligence, helping guide people into their organismic intelligence, the deep felt sense capacity to perceive that and the connectedness of that to the natural world, to the natural process. So it will for always be a kind of conversation in our organization of, yeah, all of us are going to make mistakes. Emily did. We all do. That's part of the process of inquiry. And then there's like there's a way where, yes, somebody might be out there like kind of going off, but what I see is it doesn't last very long, or that teacher just doesn't last very long. Mm-hmm. There's some kind of intelligence in most of the people who study the work. There's a kind of intelligence to know. And so somebody might get a bad experience, so-called, of Continuum with one person who's not really rooted enough. They're off on flying this way or that way. And then the truth is that almost every student, it's not always the work itself. It's their resonance with the person who's teaching,
mm-hmm,
style of the teacher, and the way of meeting. Like every student that I have calls teachings through me in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not just there to kind of like be a minister telling this is the dogma, this is the thing to believe. Like, no, it's an inquiry process. And so as I'm engaging with someone, just like this conversation, you're calling out, you're calling through me different ways of responding to you in the way we're musing together.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an understanding of the student-teacher dynamism is that both are offering an intelligent process. We're both combining to help create the process of the work. And so, yes, we'll probably always have some inquiry about, is this continuum? But at the same time, like people who have the experience of continuum throughout Emily's lifetime, then if they studied at a certain point, they would say, oh, it's like this. We do core movements and there's no music and everything is very silent. And then somebody else will be, oh, no, no, it's all sounding. No, no, no. It's like there were so many phases of it. So my experience being with Emily and participating with her and co-teaching with her for, I don't know, 38 years, whatever, something like that before she died, was that the innovative processes, they flow through. And some things really stick and work and some things do not. And that it's important to listen for that, just to keep listening for that, like what really begins to take hold and develop and unfold itself. It's like, I'm sure in nature, there's different species that were tried out for a little while and then they just never really made
it. Absolutely.
Yes, exactly. Because it just it didn't fit in the ecosystem, didn't have the conversation. Yeah. Same as we're exploring, we're going to find things like that. And Emily would often speak to, and we would speak to, like connecting to the creative flux that's in the universe. And then it comes through human beings in all different forms, not just human beings, in the sharks and the whales and the dolphins and creatures, but of human beings, creative flux is coming through. So what I resonated with was this ability like to go into the deep waters and come up with a discovery and teach it. But one could teach all the discoveries that Emily made only, but not teach the process of discovery.
Mm.
I feel like you're missing the boat then for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like life is, Suzuki Roshi said this. He said, life is setting out to sail in a boat that will inevitably sink. And so can you also give consciousness time to the sea, to the great mystery? And so I feel like, okay, process of discovery, that I'm all over that in all the different ways, perceiving discovery, emotional discovery, mental discovery, somatic discovery. Let's go for that.
How many people are in the association of continuum teachers or whatever that is?
We're somewhere between 80 and 90 teachers. Mm. People are really listening in. They're coming from all over. And when I first started taking continuum, traveling with it in 1992 to Europe, I really thought I was invited to come to Germany and Finland. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is going to be an LA woo-woo, LA being Los Angeles, an LA woo-woo kind of a thing. I'm like, will it be relevant in Finland? Will it be relevant in Germany? It was completely relevant, differently. I have to meet each culture and the cultural frames. I have to do that in every part of the United States, meet the different cultural frames. But the deep 70 trillion cells of us and the intelligence, the organic intelligence of us, operates in all bodies, whether it's a Finnish body or a German body or an American body or a Thai body. Or a Borneo body. It's like it's all operating and it's connected again to the natural world, to the elemental intelligences of fire and water and air and earth and space. Mm. And those intelligences inform us, they shape us, they co-arise all of us. And then each of us culturally frames habits of perceiving and habits of movement, habits of thinking based on our culture. It's so narrow. Like how can we come past our cultural frame, whatever it is, know the gifts of it, but also know, hey, there's a much bigger version of reality that we might experience.
Yeah. And it's such a mystery to the, you know, everyone, excuse me, everyone is from in shaped by the the culture they're immersed in. And yet we also know that there are people who pop up in all sorts of places who, you know, it's kind of like wild horses, right? Some take to the saddle, just like, yeah, cool, this is good. I don't mind this. Minded it at first, but I'm good. And then there are some that are, you know, they are something else, right? And the culture seems, yeah, sure, they're in it, but it doesn't bend and twist and shape them and harden them in particular ways. They seem driven by or drawn by other things. So it's really, that's so wonderful.
It's a great analogy, David. It's great. I like to say that. It's like that's who mostly shows up for this kind of work, are those who just know there's more. And that, like, when that wild horse that won't take the saddle, because its own spirit, its own soul is so strong, it knows that it needs the wild, needs that deep relationship with wild nature too, and that it's not going to be comfortable just only being ridden by usually often humans who are not necessarily that attuned. Sometimes they, and sometimes they're not.
I'm not sure if this is shifting gears or just or it's a bad metaphor to use with you. Gears are so mechanical and you are so not, but so I know you are in all sorts of ways informed by your work with Continuum and not limiting it to that. But I also know, like, for instance, I don't know if that's still happening, but you were I don't know if there were workshops or you were co-teaching or something like that with, for instance, Lama Drime. And I don't know much, hardly anything about what he does, but I was wondering if what you brought to the, if part of what you do with Continuum is bring it to other practices, other ways of people exploring, right? You know, or people discovering or people doing whatever they're doing, and that's what you do, or, you know what I mean?
Yes. So you're asking about my co-teaching with Lama Drime.
Yeah. And but also, elsewhere.
Exactly. I'd like to definitely talk about that. And before that, I just want to name Hubert Godard. He's a French teacher of movement, perceiving, meaning making, coordination. I was able to co-teach with him for 12 years. I learned so much from him. And so all of the things that I learn, I do fold that into the ways that I teach Continuum. And then I also teach other bodies of work that have Continuum as a base, but aren't all Continuum. So I have body of perception or body of relating, working with the whole emotional psyche relating process or dream work and so on. Lama Drime, I also had the privilege of teaching with him for 12 years. And he is a Dzogchen lineage holder in the Vajrayana Buddhist religion. And he's quite unique. The basic primal teachings of Dzogchen, I feel, are so similar, different, but similar to like root beliefs and principles in Continuum. And there's a great sense of wholeness in the process. And what he experienced was in his participating in Continuum is that it brought a somatic, deep experiential way for people to understand also Buddhist insights. That many people were working with Buddhist insights, but more from a mental point of view. And needed to come like really all the way down into experiential felt sense ways of exploring in perceiving.
Mm-hmm.
And just a very simple perceiving example. And this one was also Hubert Godard was really big on this, and many different people in different realms of inquiry are all on this, which is the capacity of attention to zoom in, focus, and to be able to zoom out, way out to a, you could call it in one way, you could call it a field of awareness. And then there's our personal awareness. So whatever, however I've developed my personal awareness and the capacity to let my personal awareness keep resting into great primal awareness that's mm-hmm. inside of really everything. And so that capacity of playing with one's attention. So in Continuum, as you may remember, way, way, way back when, in the 70s, we'd be playing with a sound or let's say a movement in a particular place in the body, and then the invitation for open attention. And that is to loosen any intention, open attention throughout the whole feeling field, and to then perceive whatever starts to emerge, bubble up, that maybe one has not ever felt before.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe in opening attention, someone feels a knot, a tension that's both physical and emotional, psychological. And then in the attentive process, to be able to come and be with that and give some time for that knot to start to unpack itself, unfold, detangle, so to speak, by a larger, greater engagement, participating in so many playful and deep listening ways that something that's been knotted up for a long time could start to unfold itself and rejoin the living flow, the living currency, the living matrix. And so the simple capacity to do that, I zoom in on something I'm attending, whatever it is, and then come to the horizons. Just invite everybody who's listening to this call for right now, like just feel the horizons all around you. And you let your consciousness like take a big space for a little bit. And it's like, okay, the horizon to the north of me and the south of me and the east and west. And then there's something that happens in the energetic field. And then I can come back to that thing I was kind of obsessed on or focused on, and all of a sudden there's another perspective that I can view it from. And just the capacity to zoom out, zoom in frequently in a day is incredibly healthy for the whole body nervous system. And this capacity of deep zoom out into the body of space is part of a part of the Dzogchen practice. It's also part of the practice of our work. And just that, like Hubert would often say, like, give up your preoccupation with the bad guy inside, meaning whatever tension or pain you were with. You want to, of course, feel that, attend to it. But when we're preoccupied with whatever it is, we tighten the knot. Like, oh, how could I fix this? How can I move this? I want this better, of course, because we're in some anguish. But at the same time, like when I loosen my eyes, when I loosen my ears, I come back to even a single moment of marveling at the world, a plant, something that can help my felt sense of tension open. In that very moment of marveling, I am reshaping my physical body. There's like that moment of marveling, my viscera widens, my gut widens, my heart softens. I'm reshaping my fixity of identity right in that very moment. And in that moment, whatever I've been preoccupied on has a larger field of feeling, a larger field of presence, a larger field of resonance in which healing can begin to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to get off our obsessing. When we're obsessing on anything, like as soon as we're in that, we're in a high focal gaze on somebody or something. And So it's like if I'm obsessing in relationship, it's like only if you could only get it together, I'd be good. I'd be fine. Right. And it's like, that's kind
Isn't
of
that
like
true?
Normal relationship, except that I don't ever notice that I'm the one in obsessing mode. And therefore, like I'm in a fixed, and I'm in it. I fixed my image of you. I don't allow for you. And so then you have a hard time too, making a different move, because I've already set the dynamism. So it's like, okay, all relationships need a lot of zoom in. I'm right here with you. And zoom out. I'm here in the context. We are here together in the context. That's a really different. That puts the third context. I'm here. I'm with you. And we are in a context. We're in space. We are in a shared ground. We are in a larger space, spatial context. That is like immediately great for every relationship.
I think you're right. I think you're right. I have no doubt, which is always dangerous.
Well, on the other hand, in one of the ancient China, the San Buddhists, they would say, great doubt, great awakening. No doubt, no awakening.
Right.
But you also need to have doubt until you know by very direct experience. And you just had direct experience, why you said no doubt. But we need enough doubt to question our ideologies and our beliefs, right?
Yes.
So that we actually enter into inquiry, and then we can come in really deep, deep, deep discovery or insight. It rearranges all the inner matrix at a tissue level, at a mind, heart, mind level.
It's, I'm trying to remember who said it. It's not that everything is problematic. It's just that everything is dangerous if you get stuck there. Yeah, it's a, you know, for me that the territory where that happens, well, there's two that are, it's almost like they're guaranteed to open my mind. One is gazing at the night stars, and the other is paying attention to language in its most particular way. You know, the fact that forming particular sounds can be a tool to share meaning, or particular squiggles. And you know that I just said, stop at the light. And it, you know, I mean, it's miraculous, as is, you know, for me, gazing at the night. It's like, so, well, Susan Harper,
that's a beautiful place to go there. Like that place to be with a starry night. Like we have so much resonance in the stardust that makes up our minerals and part of our blood, right? So we have a stellar body, you could say. And when you're communing like that with the night sky, and you're communing with the vastness and those little amazing luminous dots of light that are the stars, and then we're touching in that moment a kind of a wordless, full of silent meaning. And there's like such a, again, a rapport with the star field, with the night sky, with the darkness, with the amount of space that's there. And one's own inner spaciousness, the capacity for astonishment, whatever that is, whatever helps anybody who's listening to this call be astonished again, that capacity to marvel, to wonder, to be astonished, to come back into awe, that rearranges a life. Mm-hmm. That gets your heart intelligence going.
That's so interesting. I think we just came back to the beginning of our conversation, is what does Susan Harper do? This.
Yes, exactly. I never know quite what to say when
people. Oh, no, exactly. Well, Susan Harper, thank you so much for being willing to spend some time and reacquaint and all of those things. And who knows? Maybe this is part one. Never know what part two looks like.
Yes, indeed, David. A pleasure to be in the conversation with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryant here on LA Talk Radio.